we can start.
Okay, well, thank you, Trevor, for that introduction. I am going to provide you with an example of impure paperism, because I'm going to interrupt myself at certain points. That is, I'm going to read this thing. Hopefully it won't look too unfamiliar to me as I do it. The thing I'm going to present to you is a consideration of some problems that come out of this book, Relational Aesthetics. That's a relatively recent book that deals with contemporary art involved in the construction of social situations. My particular angle of attack is retrospective, that is, by looking at projects in the 50s and 1960s that dealt with many of similar kinds of questions, and asking what those projects might provide as sort of interesting counterpoints to what this idea of relational aesthetics is and does. And I'm going to further preface that by saying there is a woman, Claire Bishop, who's written very, very interestingly and critically about relational aesthetics from a contemporary point of view. And if we get there and I don't sort of gas on too long, I'll just do a brief overview of what it is that she does. But again, she deals with the radically contemporary, the now, and I'm looking back at the 50s and 1960s. Loosely, the concept of relational aesthetics is one that that has to do with a way of bundling and packaging some contemporary projects that seem all to deal with the construction of social situations and social spaces, and those projects. I'll provide you with a couple of examples, but those projects have been one of the hottest commodities, although there's not really a commodity per se, but one of the hottest commodities on the global festival circuit. So I'm kind of interested in that too, how a project that is immaterial and about the construction of social relations becomes a commodity. And I apologize as well for the use of PowerPoint. I know that's supposed to be bad, but since I'm a paperist, I'll also be a PowerPointist. Okay, and my paper is titled The Open Work, Participatory Art Since Silence, Silence being John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Also, if at any point you want me to clarify something, please don't hesitate to interrupt. I have a funny feeling we'll sort of stop before I'm finished with what I've written and enter into questions as well, but we'll see how it goes. Okay. And I begin by talking about this text, this man, Nicolas Bourriaud. In the introduction to his 1998 book, Relational Aesthetics, which we have in English from 2002, the curator, Nicolas Bourriaud, writes that currently the liveliest factor that is played out on the chessboard of art has to do with interactive, user-friendly, and relational concepts. The list of artists to whom he refers reads like the most wanted list for the international art market and circuit of the past decade: Pierre Huyghe, Vanessa Beecroft, Maurizio Cattelan, Rikrit Chiravanija. These artists, he writes, are not connected together by any style, theme, or iconography. What they do share is much more decisive, to wit, the fact of operating within one and the same practical and theoretical horizon, the sphere of interhuman relations. And I'm showing you two relatively recent examples of projects that fall under that rubric. Work by Liam Gillick on the top, which is a sort of an expanded Frank Stella into the space of corporate office design. And below, a collaboration between Chiravanija and Superflex, social pudding that is both a space and a kind of event space in which people are meant to gather and actually eat pudding together and be sort of social and be social pudding. The resulting works of Bourriaud's theorizing, he thinks of as, quote, hands-on utopias. And he says the artwork of the 1990s turns the beholder into a neighbor. It is the object of his small book to not only bring some coherence to the category these works define, but also to elucidate some of the terms of that category. Quote, the artwork is presented as a social interstice within which these experiments and new life possibilities appear to be possible, end quote. Bourriaud's claim is that this new work, quote, in no way draws sustenance from any reinterpretation of this or that past aesthetic movement. Neither utopian nor formalist relational aesthetics emphasizes immediacy, contingency, service, and has at its core what Claire Bishop has glossed as a, quote, DIY microtopian ethos, end quote, that is fundamentally political. Neither revival nor comeback relational aesthetics is a vanguardist response to a world saturated by mass communications. And for Bourriaud, quote, the first question has to do with the material form of these works. How are these apparently elusive works to be decoded, be they process-related or behavioral, by ceasing to take shelter behind 60s art history? This last is a defensive maneuver, and as such, it is one that needs to be taken on. In developing his theory of relational aesthetics, Bourriaud was trying to do several things: to assemble like-minded artists and works, that's a curatorial project, to give them a pedigree, which is a museological task, and to prove that the issues involved were at the same time new and radically contemporary. That's a critical task, but also well within the vanguardist tradition that is the shock of the new. What kind of art was possible after the doldrums of the 1980s, when the hegemony of spectacle seemed assured, after the alleged failures of May 1968, after institutional critique seemed to have run its course, and after any socially engaged avant-garde had exhausted itself and the political patience of its adherents, and even perhaps the conditions of its possibility? I'll be relatively straightforward about my allegiances. Though the rubric of relational aesthetics has provided an extremely useful conceptual frame through which to understand the gambits of a number of important contemporary projects, it's a frame that needs a little interrogating. I don't want to make the argument that it was all done before, nor do I want to bemoan the good old days. Bourriaud's writing has been criticized for a degree of theoretical weakness. It's not my object to repeat those criticisms. Rather, what I want to address is his dismissal of those 60s art practices to which he ascribes a grand sheltering capacity. I want to ask what Bourriaud's defensive move might have obscured in that 60s work, and what it might tell us about contemporary practice. And I want to do so by putting those terms Bourriaud has retrofitted, interactive, user-friendly, relational, back into the, or at least a, historical perspective that Bourriaud has willfully rejected. Okay, so what I'm going to do is take his terms and remap them back onto earlier works. Relational aesthetics is predicated on the activation of the audience, and Bourriaud points to one important theoretical precedent. This activation was strategically confirmed and endorsed for visual artists in 1957 by Marcel Duchamp in recorded and much distributed comments made at a conference in Houston, to which Bourriaud refers. In The Creative Act, and I'm giving you, you know, one of the chief quotes from that piece, in The Creative Act, Duchamp eschewed an intentional model of artistic production, suggesting instead that the art coefficient of an artwork lay precisely in those aspects of it that were not accounted for by the artist. The art coefficient lay in the quasi-contractual or even collaborative relationship between the artist and the audience. Duchamp is an obvious reference point, but the conditions for a fortuitous reception of his remarks, which would be critically and academically codified by Arthur Danto some 7 years later, were already in place. That is, what makes the Duchamp remarks sort of acceptable and even celebrated is not simply their own substance, but the fact that there was an audience ready for them. He had a prepared audience. Okay. A prior watershed moment, at least in the U.S., had already radically opened the creative field with respect to both material and audience awareness. This was the first performance of John Cage's 1952 composition, 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Cage's piece is one of the prime examples of indeterminacy in composition. It's also an example of what the critic Umberto Eco would call an open work. So my talk will be addressed loosely to three overlapping ideas. One, the question of participation and how to think about participation. Two, the open work, and more specifically, what Eco calls the work in motion. And three, the problematic presented by artistic autonomy, both as it was understood in the 60s and as we might see it in more contemporary practices. I may not get to this last, but it subtends the others, and I think you'll see it underpins both the notion of participation and that of the open work. So what I'm going to do is a kind of textual reading of an essay by Eco, and then sort of retell the myth of 4 minutes and 33 seconds. I want to propose, first to propose a loose typology of participation. It's possible to think about participation in at least three ways, each of which proposes a different idea of competence. And I want to emphasize this is very loose and a little bit rock and roll, but we're going to try it anyway. Philosopher David Novitz, writing on participatory art and appreciative practice, provides a useful, weak definition. It is well known, he writes, that there are degrees of appreciation. His interest is in an underappreciated set of artworks, quoting him, those largely neglected art forms that cannot adequately be appreciated and cannot function properly unless the viewer is physically present in the artwork itself or a performance of it, and while there, participates in certain activities that arise out of and are required by these works. For Novitz, participation is another word for a kind of immersive, physiological engagement. Hence, the examples provided by him are largely architectural, and interestingly, the majority are pre-20th century examples. So when he thinks about participation, he's really thinking in a very general sense about being in a place, right, and moving through it. Thus, a weak definition of participation holds that any physical engagement is participation, to be enhanced by what Novitz calls appreciation. So you're kind of in the thing and aware of being in the thing. While this clearly relates to Duchamp's own position, it presents us with a modified communications model that says the work is in some sense completed in the experience of the viewer. Its weakness lies in its availability or even applicability to any artwork that grabs our attention. And if participation in this definition is equivalent to engagement, which implies interpretation, the set of encounters with artworks to which it applies is very large. While the definition has the advantage of undermining the modernist fiction of art's autonomy, we're forced to acknowledge that it is never anything other than conditional. Its broad generality makes it relatively useless for describing the properties of specific projects. So I've taken this philosopher who's trying to arrive at, in a sort of typically Anglo-philosophical way, a very simple definition of participation. And I'm providing this as a weak definition. What I'm showing you here is, some of you have seen this already today, Robert Rauschenberg in front of some of his white paintings, which are understood as works that invite that kind of awareness and engagement that might be provided for in this weak definition. A second, stronger definition understands participation in a more active sense as an extension of engagement. Into this category, and I'm showing you here a second Rauschenberg, and I'll talk about it in a second. Into this category, for example, I put much old new media art in which the viewer is presented with the possibility of navigating through a limited range of options, each with a determinate outcome. That navigation doesn't change the form of the artwork. While this kind of participation does involve some degree of conscious navigation, it nevertheless lacks a sense of responsibility beyond the immediate obligation to twiddle or to observe. I'm showing you a Rauschenberg combine, an early combine. I'm not sure if this is up at the Metropolitan Museum in New York in the show. But in any event, it's usually shown as a sort of freestanding movement of painting out into space, into this kind of structure that Rauschenberg called a combine. What's usually left out of the account of this particular piece is that it was also a stage prop for dance, right? So it's actually constructed to be walked through, both through those curtains that you see there and through penetrated this way and engaged with very actively. Okay, so there's a kind of conscious navigation, a certain degree of responsibility, move this, do that, think about this. Also in this category might be the genre of museum education project, not in itself a bad thing, but very questionably of interest for its participatory aspect, so it's kind of limited participation. But I want to keep in sight those paratactical museum educational projects such as guided tours by artists like Andrea Fraser or Janet Cardiff, and the now classic institution-critical interventions of artists like Hans Hacke. And you see here a documentary image of his MoMA pole. These are works in which you have a very simple obligation with respect to the work, but as you sort of fulfill that obligation, presumably you're sort of changing to some extent the outcome of the work, and you're having a realization about what the work is showing you. These kinds of projects are historically self-conscious, post-ready-made works which understand the art institution itself as a ready-made. These works involve participants or tourists even, but the role of the artist in shaping both form and content of the work is foregrounded, and the outcome is to a large extent predictable. Even in the case of the MoMA poll, it's reasonably predictable, or was, that there would be more votes saying we should get out of Vietnam than we should stay there, which is what these people are doing. They're dropping their tickets into one of two ballot possibilities, a yes or no vote about Governor Nelson Rockefeller. Finally, the strongest definition necessitates a more precise and active notion of participation. Under this rubric, participation involves a conscious decision-making, action taking on the part of the participant in such a way that the structure of the work itself is shaped by that activity. This kind of participation, what Umberto Eco calls an oriented insertion, yields the actual reconfiguration of the artwork. And the piece I'm showing you here is a sort of ongoing cumulative work by the Fluxus artist Allison Knowles, Bean Game, that you as the viewer are no longer viewing. You're actually a user. You go in there and mess around with it and do stuff with it. So this kind of participation yields the actual reconfiguration of the work. The work is iterable. No two performances will be the same. No two apprehensions will be the same. The artist's embrace of chance extends itself to the received form of the work itself. I've already mentioned Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which is an example of precisely this kind of project. In his crucial 1962 essay, The Open Work, Umberto Eco describes other new works in music in which the performer is a decision maker. But this essay was not simply about new music, about Berio, Stockhausen, or Schaeffer. It was a productive theorizing that had emerged from Eco's consideration of music and literature and the visual arts. That is, Eco was describing a broader development in Western cultural production of the 50s and early 1960s. The open work can exist across multiple disciplines, and that multidisciplinarity is a crucial thing to bear in mind, or that sort of interpenetrability of disciplines. What are open works? Quoting Eco, in primitive terms, we can say that they are quite literally unfinished, writes Eco. The author seems to hand them on to the performer more or less like the components of a construction kit. He seems to be unconcerned about the manner of their eventual deployment. Open works, again quoting Eco, reject the definitive concluded message and multiply the formal possibilities of the distribution of their elements. They appeal to the initiative of the individual performer, and hence they offer themselves not as finite works which prescribe specific repetition along given structural coordinates, but as open works which are brought to their conclusion by the performer at the same time as he experiences them on an aesthetic plane. And he notes, that the practical intervention of a, quote, performer is different from that of an interpreter in the sense of consumer, though both can be seen as different manifestations of the same interpretative attitude. Thus, the open work is not predicated on completion by an addressee's consumption or enjoyment of the same form the artist originally presented. Under our weak definition of participation, as Echo correctly notes, every reception of a work of art is both an interpretation and a performance of it. But the open work is marked by, quote, the autonomy left to the individual performer in the way he chooses to play the work, requiring that the performer not only interpret instructions, but also impose judgment on the form of the piece. In other words, what Echo's saying is, well, anytime you look at a work of art, you're doing some kind of interpretative activity. But these open works are works that make that integral to their structure, that interpretation. They foreground its necessity and make yield a beholder, a viewer, a player who is an active decision maker in the production of the piece. That is also to say, incomplete knowledge is a structural principle of the piece. It's unfinished at some level. One result of this idea of the open work is what Echo calls the production of a field of relations, and he's working with field theory and quasi-science language. Intentionally, he wants to sort of emphasize the modernity or even contemporaneity of his concept of the open work. He says these works establish a field of relations, that is, a set of possibilities rather than a finite thread. And the most advanced of those open works, the most demanding in a way, are works that mine that set of possibilities to the extreme. Those works he calls works in movement. While I don't want to claim participatory art is only ever a contemporary phenomenon, it's nevertheless clear that something changed in the post-World War II era that was historically significant. And so this change was registered in the cultural arenas of music, the visual arts, the performing arts, and in literature, and made itself felt through a new emphasis on process, on experiment, on the activation of performers and participants, and on the strategic and conceptual crossovers from one arena of activity to another. Now remember, Bourriaud saying, it doesn't matter what material my artist works in, you know, they all work in different materials, they're experimenting, they're activating these social spaces, and so on. So there's a lot of, there's a set of terms, there's a kind of terminology that is at least similar, right? The title of my talk, The Open Work, Participatory Arts and Silence, is a little misleading since it implies that in some measure the open work and participatory art are equivalent. But I like to think of that dividing colon as implying on the left side a kind of broad category that on the right side will qualify, or give a specific iteration of. The open work is not the same as participatory art. It's not a reflexive pairing. Rather, the open work implies participation, but of a very particular kind. That is, the open work requires an active, cognitive participation, including physical engagement, that goes beyond a weak description of participation simply as awareness or presence, and towards participation as an active decision-making. Further, the open work takes that cognitive participation as a structural necessity in a way that a weak definition of participation cannot fully encompass. And finally, in the open work, the iterability of the work is a structuring problematic. All right, and that's the nature of a work in movement, that it's constantly iterable. I'd like to retell a familiar story. It's the story of John Cage's silent piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which was composed, or rather given a score, and first performed in 1952. 4 minutes and 33 seconds was premiered one rainy evening in 1952 in Woodstock, New York, as part of a concert devoted to a chronological recital of Cage's compositions. It was performed by the pianist David Tudor, who had been with Cage at Black Mountain College the previous year. 4 minutes and 33 seconds punctuated Cage's career to date. The piece was a kind of semicolon, dividing off more traditional compositional concerns from subsequent preoccupations. His composition removed expressivity from duration, harmony, and touch, relying on the auditory capacities of his audience to play the piece. And when Tudor played this piece, he came in gave the audience visual cues to the three movements. Three movements of specific but unequal clock duration, each marked tacit or silence, make up the score for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. In this piece, Cage, by both rigidly specifying the duration of silence and tacitly accepting the impossibility of silence, except as a written instruction, at once leached out musical expressivity and confirmed the textuality of music. Throughout his career, he contended that 4 minutes and 33 seconds produced an active kind of listening, and its terms encompass the renunciation of interpretive closure and an opening out onto what Roland Barthes called the raw and vertical shimmering of polysemy. In other words, he's opened out an interpretive space, but also forced his audience to accept that role of interpreter. The complex articulated by 4 minutes and 33 seconds is heterogeneous. Among the various interpretive lenses through which this piece has been examined are, alongside McCarthyite repression, Zen, Heisenbergian uncertainty, and the history of Muzak. So there's not only the experience of the piece itself, but then the way in which the piece has been framed by historians that is not as radically open, but is also open. For some, in the context of the early 1950s, an era much like our own of repressive politics in which an anti-communist, geopolitically isolationist, triumphalist, and eminently family-oriented post-war state determined through the exercise of legal injunctions and punishments, as well as social prohibitions, the norms of private life, and the parameters of everyday life. So for people who focus on that, Cage's silent 4 minutes and 33 seconds seemed an extraordinary surrender of voice. That is, it encoded the passivity of the composer confronted with the musical bar, of the performer confronted with the score commanding silence, and of the audience confronted with the lack of performance. For others, however, the piece provided a much-needed wake-up call. Indeed, that call was an answer to the uncomfortable quietism of the 1950s. Alan Capra, then 25 and a philosophy student at NYU, was in the audience of the second performance of 4 minutes and 33 seconds at Carnegie Recital Hall in New York. And so this audience, the second audience, was pretty much a prepared audience for the piece. For Capra, Cage's silent piece expanded the notions of both composition and performance to include not simply the intentional production of sound, the production of attention to sound, and beyond that, as with Rauschenberg's white paintings, of attention to contingent phenomena. Quoting Capra, "I was very struck by 4 minutes and 33 seconds. I intuited that it was Cage's most philosophically and radically instrumental piece. Instrumental in the sense that it made available to a number of us not just the sounds in the world, but all phenomena. Then the question is, now that everything's available, what do you do?" What 4 minutes and 33 seconds proposed was, in the words of Echo, a new relationship between the contemplation and the utilization of a work of art, and that presented a problem, a rich problematic. Cage's silent piece, in part because it was so dramatically visual, presented to visual artists a new understanding of the field of relations available to nominally visual art. From 1957 to 1958, Cage intermittently taught a composition class at the New School for Social Research in New York. And among the students were many of the characters who would go on to produce event work in the 1960s, including Capra, but also Jim Dine, the pop painter, George Brecht, Dick Higgins, James Tenney, Toshi Ichiyanagi, and so on. Two of the most extraordinarily productive outgrowths of the Cage course at the New School were the time-based arts that emerged under the aegis first of Happenings and then of Fluxus. Both were rule-bound, intense investigations of time and its spatialization, as well as of the definition of art, materials, and production, They were radically material, immersive, hybrid, and performative. They were funky, amateurish, and fundamentally social. So all of those terms I've just set out are terms that are embedded in the works that I showed you right at the very beginning, these kind of relational aesthetics works. And all of those terms are present in the 60s, late 50s, early 60s moment. And I'm just isolating two clusters. There are other clusters that are in operation and formation as well. So now I'm going to talk about those two clusters. Happenings, though often chance generated, were scripted like Fluxus pieces, but much more complex. The happenings were proto-performance projects. Usually involving multiple individuals and a sort of collage aesthetic. They grew out of an expanded collage practice in which viewers had been increasingly given something to do, and throughout the early 1960s were, in the work of certain artists, increasingly participatory in that strong sense. Alan Caprow's first happening, and the one which gave us the name for the form, was 18 happenings in 6 parts. And I'm showing you 3 images of rehearsals and rehearsal space of this piece. This piece was rigid, even behaviorist, and but its score was nevertheless chance-derived, and it activated the audience in several ways. Like 4 minutes and 33 seconds in a certain way, it's kind of a hinge piece that produces certain problematics that are very rich to later artists to think about. So it activates its audience in several ways. And there is an audience. The audience sits, you can see right back here. This is Caprow himself sitting where the audience would sit. And here's little seats also for audience members. So there's a distinction between audience and performers. So it activates the audience in several ways, by breaking it up into 3 clusters and moving these clusters around in response to audio cues, and by not providing a coherent whole view or narrative. In other words, there's only ever a sort of partial sense of what is taking place, while there are cues that there are things unavailable to view in other little sections. There's also this very interesting behavioristic aspect of the piece where there are bells going off and then you have to get up and go move to the next thing and then another bell goes off and you have to move around. So this is a very interesting kind of depersonalizing that's taking place. While the rigidity of this piece was an exception rather than a rule, happenings in general were single-authored works that made use of multiple participants and that assembled non-narrative events and activities in a collage-like manner. I'm showing you two different, very different kinds of works and images from those works, one by Klaus Oldenburg on your right. A work that took place in an enclosed space that involved a small degree of rehearsal, but also sort of collage-like, and very clearly uses bodies as objects. Right. There are at least 4 bodies in this piece, not including the person standing up in the back. And on the left, Caprow's last sort of overly spectacularized piece, Gas, which was made for television. Generally speaking, happenings are single-authored works that made use of multiple participants and that assembled non-narrative events and activities in a collage-like manner. They were not acted or performed, they were done. So it was very important that the people participating in them not be engaged in presenting some sort of illusionistic character or some sense of a displaced second identity. Generally speaking, they were radically divested from expression. As the form developed, artists increasingly moved away from a model in which there was some distinction between audience and performers, and for those who kept working in the arena of live arts, became more and more involved with works involving either a closed set of participants and no observers, or with works open to the public at large. The result was what one critic has called a kind of collaboration without objects. So what happened was, as artists worked with this form and format, they discovered a couple of things. One, if there are photographers there doing documentation of the piece, people begin to act. They begin to do the piece for the photographer. So photography gets banished over time. And then the second thing is if there's an audience, people begin also to act. It's very important for many of these practitioners that when you're participating in the piece, you are in the piece, not thinking I'm in the piece, but I'm also in the documentation. So there's an investment in presence, but also developing understanding that a certain kind of spectacularization disrupts that presentness. Joint production characterized Fluxus in its identification as a group project with, as the impresario George Machunas put it, socially constructive objectives. Ensemble work, festivals, communal meals, games, and group publications reinforced this sense, as did the practices afforded by the device of the open score of realizing each other's concepts and performing each other's pieces. And I'm showing you, Tony, you probably know better than I do, but I'm showing you a Flux kit here with a number of different scores and works by a variety of Fluxus artists. It's like a kind of curated show slash concert in the form of a portable briefcase full of multiples. And then on the top, as a sort of, I guess, memoriam, an image of Nam June Paik playing a piece, and I think he was playing Lamont Young's composition to Robert Morris, right? Draw a line? Draw a straight line and follow it. I think that's what he's doing. And he's doing it with tomato juice and ink, right? So he's interpreting a score, right? Written for a proto-minimal, at that moment, sculptor. These are scores in here. Water Yam by George Brecht. There's scores in here by Robert Watts. I think this is a Yoko Ono piece. Mieko Shiomi up here. Box design by George Machunas, incredible artist who never gets called an artist. Box by an artist named Io. This is one of his finger boxes. It has a little hole. You stick your finger in it and get a surprise, either nasty or nice. All of these things are made in multiple and very, very cheaply. So they're done in such a way that they kind of attack the notion of preciousness and attack the notion that artworks are made not to be touched, right, and only to be put on a pedestal and seen. This is about playing with stuff and moving it around. Making arrangements, and it's about a kind of collectivity, right? The collectivity of the work itself. The kinds of scores produced by Fluxus artists were not so much instructional as directive, performative, and indeterminate. For, as the artist Dick Higgins explained, each work has a unique gestalt which no single performance or notation can totally realize. Fluxus was also, like Happenings, anti-professional. The importance of dilettantism, combined, of course, with high seriousness of execution, was one lesson in democracy learned from Cage's classes. And that's very, very important. It's anti-professional. And one of the things that, there's a man named George Machunas who's kind of the sort of chief designer of Fluxus stuff. And he's absolutely insistent to all of the artists who want to produce things under the brand name of Fluxus that you never call yourself an artist. It's not a profession, right? It's an avocation. It's not a vocation, it's an avocation. Because the minute you call yourself an artist, what you've done is turn something that should be an enjoyable, pleasurable activity that's about a kind of fun and everyday exploration into something that's about the production of cultural capital and commodity. Fluxus emphasized monomorphic verbal pun structures, musically based ensemble events, and many of the artists came out of the musical arena, so they were used to playing scores and working together. Because many of those artists came from that kind of background, Flux's performances seem to be much more naturally collaborative than the Happenings, which had emerged from the more privatized practice of painting. So it's true of Flux's works that lots of people go and perform this piece, in serial, in many, many ways. One wasn't possessive about the piece itself. Whereas with Happenings, generally there's one artist who's kind of controlling the event to some degree. The ruling model was low theater, cheap entertainment, carny fare, popular forms with an emphasis on humor and physical one-liners, immediate and concrete in their apprehension. What both of these practices, Fluxus and Happenings, share in greater or lesser degree was a kind of internationalism, an investment in low humor, the use of ordinary or even junk materials, a radical eclecticism, and an expansion of the language of the ready-made. One had its grounding in painting, one in music, at least in a nominal sense. Or you could say one was sort of spatially invested, Happenings were spatially invested, Flux's events were often more temporally invested, at least at the beginning. Happenings tended to an individual authorship, but then a collective execution. Flux's flirted with collective authorship in certain qualified ways. Happenings thought of themselves as singular, one-off events, whereas Flux's event, like this kind of event, Flux's events were iterable and repeatable. They're like concerts, right? Happenings were complex. Flux's events were tended to a kind of monomorphic type of execution. Both of these types of works began to explore local forms and distributable forms. And as the 60s moved forward, there was exploration in the production of Happenings with distributing their performance over vast geographical territories and over time. In the case of Fluxus, they're very, very invested in international networks as well as mail art, which we talked about earlier, and also with the possible distribution of these kind of concerts and performances of works like the thing you see up here. Most importantly, both practices were devised as kind of paratactical critiques of the dealer, gallery, museum system. That is, both projects were trying to get out of the production of singular masterpieces that lived in a gallery space, right, and that could be sold as singular commodities. The one did it by producing an event that couldn't be bought or sold. The other did it by producing either events that worked the same way or something that was so plural cheaply made and had a infinite iteration or multiplicity that it would undermine its collectability, at least in principle. It's not really what happened. Out of these two practices and their engagements with process and importantly with behavior grew the twinned performative immaterial hybrid projects of conceptual and systems art. Charlie Gears suggested that systems art disappeared for a complex of reasons involving failures of quality of exhibitions, skepticism about industrial and technocratic linkage, problems with instrumentalism, and the difficulties of commodifying such work. All of those problems are problems that are also embedded in the reception of Happenings and Fluxus. And arguably, a similar array of problems taxed conceptual art projects throughout the 1970s as they morphed over time from critical to bureaucratic to finally institutionalized practices and gradually lost their urgency. These developments, as I've just said, had already been foreseen in neo-Dada collective and collaborative projects of the 1960s. Indeed, those projects arose in part out of a critical apprehension of precisely this kind of entropy. That is, you produce a sort of critical move, and then somehow that critical move gets embedded in the art world. And just the way that Duchamp's Fountain now becomes a qualified masterpiece and circulates that way. And if you follow the news, there's a French I guess, conceptual slash performance artist who, gosh, did he smash it this time? He pissed in it once before. But anyway, he has had various engagements with the urinal. That our engagements address precisely to the fetishization of that singular object, and its sort of rendering into preciousness. To what degree then was the concept of the work in motion, out of which these kinds of projects grew, and the sort of conceptual surround which they were exploring, to what degree was the very concept of the work in motion a kind of prophylactic against precisely the kind of bureaucratizing, institutionalizing, and devitalizing, kind of taming that eventually would take place with even the most transgressive of artworks? And to what extent has the theorizing of relational aesthetics obviated critical address to those difficulties? Remember, for Bourriau, many of the works he champions are interactive, user-friendly, relational. And they encompass service projects, networks, multiply authored works. Let's see what I've got up here. Oh, some cool examples. Networks, multiply authored works, and ongoing project type exploration. I'm showing you two different projects which I think are sort of interesting straddlers or outliers in that relational aesthetics paradigm. Both of these artists have been kind of enfolded, certain of their projects have been enfolded into the notion of relational aesthetics, and both of these projects still work also with relational ideas. The piece on the right is work that was the Hugo Boss Prize piece by Rikri Tiruvanija. He's best known, Brazilian-American Thai artist who kind of got notoriety by cooking meals and serving them to people in galleries. That was kind of a relational thing, right? You go and you have great Thai food and discuss your art world problems. I think he kind of burned out on the cooking aspect, which is an interesting thing to think of. It happens to performers a lot. But they're very interesting descriptions of what people did when they went to those early meals. Namely, they were mostly art people, and they would go and talk about art stuff. Say, like, geez, there's nothing else happening in Soho or wherever. Let's go get some Thai food at Recruits, right, and hang out there and talk about art world material. The piece that you see here was he won a very prestigious prize, the Hugo Boss Prize, that's sponsored by the Guggenheim Museum, and this was his piece for that prize. It involves the construction of a pirate cable broadcast, it's broadcast, not narrowcast, cable station in the Guggenheim. Now, one of the things that happened, I'll tell you what happened, but what you see here is a sort of two-part structure. This is sort of penetrable but opaque plywood structure. It's also the kind of very late minimalism, both of these are, and it's very interesting how these artists reuse and recycle sort of minimalist language. So there's a glassed-in structure here that is visually penetrable, but you can't get into it. And then this opaque structure here, inside of which there's a monitor playing some of this cable, and then a sort of enclosed cable broadcasting device. Up here is a version of Duchamp's bicycle wheel, a ready-made. So it's a reference to the historical avant-garde. It's serving as an antenna. In other words, he's taken this useless object, ready-made, that's been turned into a useless object and rendered it useful. And then in the back, you can't really see it, it's right around the corner, is this a set of monitors that are actually playing they're broadcasting, sort of, a 1970s film, fiction film about a sort of re-education camp for pacifists, where American hippie pacifists are trained to be aggressive killers. And there's some other parts as well. On the wall are, in sort of blueprint format, excerpts from the FCC code about broadcasting, as well as different legal cases and documents, and then instructions for how to build your own both radio and I think cable broadcast facility, and you know, sort of homage to one of the early, you know, relational aesthetics artists. There's a pile of takeaway blueprints as well that give you instructions for how to build your own device. So the idea, this relational idea here, was that that you yourself can. You know, can broadcast, build a pirate broadcast, and then in the land of freedom of speech, there's all this legal code that prohibits you from actually kind of enacting your free speech through the airwaves, right? The airwaves are possessed by legal code. The interesting thing that happened with this piece was that because it's in the Guggenheim. It posed two problems. One was a purely practical problem. How do you, you know, broadcast it through the concrete if you have a very small facility? But the second problem was a legal one, and the Guggenheim refused to let Chervanesia broadcast. So, in fact, the thing was a narrow cast, right? So the kind of conceptual kernel of it was evacuated by its very presence in the gallery space. So it's an interesting project about a kind of failure, in fact, of communication and attempts at communication, and about the kinds of pressures, the legal codes, the institutional codes that produce, that yield that failure. The piece on the left is this wonderful, weird, have you seen this thing? No. Greenhouse built by an artist named Karsten Haller, who was trained as a biologist. And what Haller, it's a greenhouse made out of glass with real life plants in it. He's found these plants, the Solandra lily, and the Solandra lily emits a smell that maps onto human pheromone receptors. In other words, those kind of proto-smell receptors in your nasal passages that are basically sort of sexual attractant receptors, right? So you go into this thing, and these lilies are emitting a kind of smell that that you would encounter if you saw someone to whom you were incredibly sexually attracted, right? All right, and it's human size. You walk through the thing. At the same time, it's lit by strobe lights, and the strobe lights, you know, are grow lights for the plants. But there are these strobe lights blasting off at whatever it is, 60 cycles, and lighting the place. And then this smell. Right? The notion is that you, the poor user, beholder, go into this space and have a kind of bodily experience that is to some extent uncontrollable and in fact behavioral, right? You're being behaviorally stimulated by these plants, and you're being disoriented by the stroboscopic kind of still framing of your movement through the space. Both of these artists are artists who have been, as I said, enfolded into relational aesthetics. Both of these projects are projects that begin, I think, to sort of step back from some of the feel-goody aspects of what Bourriaud is talking about and begin to ask questions about social programming, both from a biologistic level and then on this more sort of legal and institutional level of coding. Okay, so for Bourriaud, many of the works he champions are interactive, user-friendly, relational. I'd say these are interactive in a qualified way. They're certainly user-friendly in the sense that it's clear how you negotiate them. Whether they're friendly is a very, very different question. And they're certainly addressed to questions of social relations. Claire Bishop, the critic Claire Bishop, has noted, however, the degree to which relational aesthetics, while working in a putatively open manner, in other words, the claim is made that and you think back to those very first two projects I showed you, that these kinds of projects set up spaces where you come and you eat pudding and art pudding together. The putatively open manner of these works, in fact, closes off difference in its valorizing and affirmation of the language of consumer choice itself as a kind of connectedness. This, Bishop says, is a sort of neoliberal program. In other words, what she's saying is there is the illusion of choice, the illusion of social connectivity. There is, an actual social connectivity, but it's very, very constrained. It's a neoliberal program in the sense that interpretation has been foreclosed. The very meaning of the work for someone like Bourriaud is that it is social or relational. I think she's right to say that this is not enough. I think there are various ways in. She makes a very coherent critique, but she remains well within an address to contemporary projects. For my purposes, by dismissing work of the 1960s, Bourriaud evades a number of key concerns that 1960s work raised. From the questioning of the gallery commodity system to addressing the nature of artistic control and freedom, the degree to which an artist actually controlled the interpretation of a work, the opening of an interpretation of the work, and even the invitation to a kind of boredom or failure and disagreement. Bishop points to a kind of antagonistic model of democracy, a kind of participation that I think is radically useful here. What she says is essentially the way in which Bourriaud presents relational projects is a way in which all of the users of those projects agree on how they're going to use the stuff. Right? You get into the social pudding space, and yes, you become part of the social pudding. And being together is really wonderful. And what she says is that as a kind of democratic notion is, in fact, profoundly limiting because it elides the possibility of difference, of disagreement, of danger, of sort of problematic. And what I want to suggest is that possibility of difficulty, of disagreement, it was present in those works in motion and the open works of the 60s in a way that's been sort of glided over by eliminating them from consideration. Some of the same problems dog aspects of new media as well, that connectivity is fabulous and it's great for everybody to use something. And it's important, I think, to qualify, in fact, what it is you get when you're connected and what it is you're using a thing to do. I think I'll stop there. Yeah, I think I will stop there. Welcome any questions or comments. So what I'm trying to do in this piece is say there's a historical moment that opens up a set of questions about authorship, about what it means to participate, about how fully you engage with a work. In happenings and in fluxus works, there's no interest in how you feel, right? That's a sort of secondary effect. The interest is simply in going through the motions of doing whatever the thing is. Not in performing it for something else, but in asking whether it's possible, in fact, to kind of inhabit yourself as you do an activity or execute a score. And it's important to note whether it is possible or is not possible that the question itself is there, right? The question of inhabiting oneself, what it is to have a self. And that question is something that relational aesthetics does not ask. Done.
Can you take this a step further? further back to Dada, or better yet, futurism, and see many of the same things happening. Or if you even extend this beyond, I mean, I think one of the things that's thrown into question is the framing influence of the term art.
Yeah.
As an institutional condition.
Yeah.
Say the Middle Ages in Europe, if you trace this tradition as a European tradition, which is perhaps its main taproot.
Mm-hmm.
As you were speaking, I kept thinking about the function of church liturgy, or the participatory art of the mass,
mm-hmm.
And how people then go and they participate and they're in it and they're part of it, and they in a sense spiritually, which was the reality of the time,
right.
They actually shape the outcome.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are other situations where this kind of model obtains in some form, So, I'm just wondering how you might feel yourself also contained by your focus on this particular period.
Thing, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In a grand global perspective, is a tempest in a teapot, really, to think about relational aesthetics. What's interesting about the moment in which we are now, and that this particular critic has tapped into in a certain way, is the resurgence of discussions of utopia and utopic projects. And what Burio argues for, he says, forget utopia, that was like the old avant-garde and it never happened, but these works present possible microtopias, like mini, tiny, provisional utopias. And that's a very compelling fantasy, and it may actually be sort of provisionally true, and we could accept that. That utopian thread goes absolutely back to certain aspects of Dada and Dada performance, but always embedded in something like Dada or futurism is a utopia, and then a recognition of the world as it is, absolutely, and a recognition of what in Israel they call facts on the ground, whatever conditions on the ground. As drawing out a utopian statement by contrast, right? So you present your utopia knowing the thing's not going to come to be, but it's a way of throwing into highlight situations in the world.
That's less so the case with futurists.
Less with futurists. It's also the case, though, futurism is also invested in still making art. Dada makes great claims to anti-art, right? And they're claims that are in a qualified way about, they're not anti-art art, they're anti-art elevated someplace else, they're anti-elite, they're really anti-elite. And futurism is anti-tradition, it wants to claim, while in certain ways it's very, 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 very traditional. What interests me in my investment in this particular moment has to do with what I think is a post-war problem in thinking about subjectivity, what it is to be a person, right? And an individual, to have individual interests and investments. And I think that after World War II, it's very, very difficult to hold a notion of yourself as a sort of totality for which you can fully account. So in a weird way, as a person yourself, you are an open work, right? And I think one of the problems with let's put it another way. One of the things I've been interested in looking at is the way in which these 50s and 60s performed works, which have generally been interpreted as kind of sweet, blithe, happy, fun, happenings were fun. When you go back and read accounts of them, they were boring, scary, dangerous, sometimes fun, but also creepy, stupid. They were a lot of other things. They were not simply about pleasure. They were about a very consistent challenge, whether it's, you know, at the sort of psychic level, boredom. People were actually stabbed at certain happenings. In one of Oldenburg's happenings, somebody got stabbed. In another one, a woman fell off a ladder, and everybody thought it was part of the happening, so they just left her there and then realized she's got to go to the hospital, you know. So there's a very interesting way in which the desire has been to see these things as sort of all about pleasure and simplicity, and that desire got mapped onto a certain kind of blithe image of the 60s when there were, I think it's possible to argue, much more aggressively addressed to a sense that identity itself was only ever partial, and that experience was a sort of fractured, fragmented, inflected by all kinds of things out in the world. And that complexity absolutely vanishes in this sort of social pudding idea. I mean, I think even I don't know about Lamont Young's stuff, but I think even with that sort of the soundscapes produced by Young, the sort of intensity of sound in which you experience your body as this kind of resonator that, you know, takes over your mental space, is another way of kind of pushing physicality and a sense of identity outside of itself, right? Stepping outside of oneself. And that, you know, there are people still working with those kinds of concepts, and that's a kind of agonistic concept of self, right? What this woman Claire Bishop does is says there's an agonistic model of democracy that says real democracy, participatory democracy, is about debate and disagreement, and not saying we disagree and you're different from me, so how are we going to get to a place where we're the same, but rather saying how can we be in a place where we are different and that difference is sustainable. And that's a very different thing than the sort of relational question. Yeah?
Can I ask a boring question? I like boring questions. I have a problem with the term user-friendly.
Yeah.
I'm really confused. If you could tell me a little bit more about how real you use it, how you interpret it, that would help.
Yeah. I think what he means... I'll put it in a mean way. I think what he means is that the way that you're meant to engage with many of these works is pretty dopey. Like, go in and eat the pudding and sit there and hang out, right? He's been involved with this place in Paris, the Palais de Tokyo, is the curator there, which is kind of a hangout. I mean, that's what you do. What he's done is, it's an extremely interesting thing that he's done. He's taken this huge building, it's kind of like a proto-fascist French building, and gutted the inside and sort of left the guts hanging there. And the office is built up in the struts of this sort of temporary strut structure. So you can see all the workings of the building. And then the cafe is open all the time, and then artists do different things with reading corners and so on. And it's a hangout in that sense. It's user-friendly in the sense that you're supposed to come and use it in the most basic of ways, right? That's, to my understanding, that's kind of what he means by user-friendly, right? That they're simple, the instructions are simple, the tools are simple. And the user-friendliness involves really your showing up and either moving through a thing or, you know, twiddling the whatever, eating the whatever, whatever it is. And doing that in good faith so that you maintain an open mind. Now, when I appropriate his, I would never say user-friendly on my own, right? But when I appropriate his user-friendliness for, let's say, a Fluxus work, there is a level of dopiness to Fluxus that's kind of compelling. But what I mean is that these works are very intentionally amateur, by which they don't mean poorly executed, but by which they do mean not made by professional artists who live outside and who make something that lives outside of our everyday arena. Does that kind of get where you're going?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you say dopey, that's like your judgment.
That's my, oh, absolutely.
No, Boyle is sitting there.
He's thinking it's great.
It's
yeah.
really awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I'm saying, you know, dopey is a sort of cheap terminology, but simple. Simple. I will say I was there at this Palais de Tokyo this, whenever it was, over Christmas, and there were these, they're sort of like,